To our upcoming CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection webinar series. Today we'll carry on with the webinar series with module number 4, our PA scoring exercise, that will focus on the groundwater migration pathway. We'll be joined by two instructors today from Tetra Tech, Inc., who includes Therese Joya, who's been with us in previous modules in the series, as well as a new presenter from Tetra Tech, David Zimmerman. But before I turn things over to our two instructors today, let me walk through a few reminders for today's broadcast session. Again, my name is Jean Valance. I'm with you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online session moderator. For those that might be new to the live broadcast and aren't quite sure what, you should have a unique email as well as a reminder email for each module in the series that gives you all of the instructions you'll need to join us live. Make sure you're referring back to the module or email for module number 4. When you do, it will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can read more about today's live broadcast. You'll find links to download the presentation materials in a few formats. There's bios and contact information for our instructors. There's even a link to our feedback form. For now, though, you'll want to click a label that says Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name as well as the number of people at your location, and then you'll be successfully checked in online, and you can join us through Adobe Connect. Just be sure to check in with the same first and last name that you used when you registered. So if your name is William but you registered under Bill, you'll want to check in with the first name Bill. If you have problems joining us online, you can simply download the slides and follow along on the phones, but just know there's some interactive polling features that you may miss out on. Audio by default is available online for all participants, so you'll actually be able to listen to this through your computer speakers or mobile devices headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, the first thing you should do is to locally check your own volume configurations. You might just need to boost the speaker output to get the online audio sufficiently loud enough. But if that doesn't work, we do have toll-free call-in information. Just use the Q&A window that appears in the lower right-hand corner to submit a question, and we'll be happy to share the call-in number for anyone who needs it. If you join us on the phones, you will be placed on a global mute, and we ask that you remain globally muted to minimize background noises and other disruptions. That Q&A window, as I referenced, is already showing up in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message for me. There's also a reminder that you can access the slides as well as other materials from our resource or links page for today's session. You can use the Q&A window to submit questions, comments, as well as report technical problems at any time. In fact, we encourage you to type up your questions and comments as soon as they occur to you. And when we get to designated breaks, we'll read through the questions out loud so that our instructors can answer them for you. Anything that's technically oriented in terms of problems or logistics, we'll work to help troubleshoot live during today's webinar. Another reminder, again, there's that message in there in the Q&A that already has a link to the seminar slides and other materials. We will be going through slides today, but we also do have an exercise handout that's been prepared, as well as a few other supplemental documents and guidance materials that might be helpful. So I encourage you to take a moment to browse through some of those resources, and at the very least, either download or print out the exercise handout and seminar slide packet for today. You might find it helpful to be able to have those at your reference during the live broadcast. Today's session is being recorded. You'll automatically get an email as a registered participant as soon as that recording is available. If you've missed the previous modules in the series, I do have recording links for modules 1, 2, and 3, so feel free to use the Q&A to request those links, and I'll be happy to share them with you. If you'd like, you can also browse the nearly 600 recorded previous seminars that we've hosted here on CLUIN through our online archive. This is a quick visual. Again, you're going to see the slides that appear in a big window on the left side. There is a button in the upper right that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that button once, it'll make the slides bigger. You can click it a second time to shrink them down. Feel free to go in and out of full screen as needed. Along the right, you'll see our CLUIN logo, the collection of related URLs. That's where you'll find the seminar resources page where you can pull up those items I mentioned earlier. You can simply click on the link of interest and press the Browse to button to open up those websites locally. It also works in the recorded version of today's webinar. And then, of course, our all-important Q&A window in the lower right corner where you can submit your comments and questions as well as technical problems at any time down below. When you're done, either hit Enter or press the cartoon-looking bubble to the right, and that'll privately submit them in. Okay, I think I've gone through everything. Again, we're going to kick off today's module number 4, our PA scoring exercise, which will focus on the groundwater migration pathway. I'm going to turn things over to our first instructor today, Therese Joya, who's joining us from Tetra Tech, Inc. So in just a moment, we'll have those slides pull up. And Therese, you can feel free to begin with module number 4.
All right, thanks, Jean. And welcome, everybody, where today we're going to talk about and generate a preliminary HRS score for one of the most commonly scored pathways for sites. The sites on the NPL, about 50% of them have scored the groundwater pathway. So this is one of the pathways that your sites are likely to affect and to generate a score on. I just wanted to mention a few logistical points from an instruction standpoint. We're going to take our first set of questions after slide 30, and then again at the end, and then we will switch instructors at about right after slide 44. There really wasn't a good breaking point, so Dave and I just decided to switch it there. And then we are not going to do screen sharing for the actual quick score. We're going to work from our screenshots to go through the quick score portion of the module. All right. So the first thing you need to make sure of at your sites when you're wanting to score the groundwater pathway is that you have an aquifer. And the aquifer definition, there is a definition of groundwater in CERCLA, and there's a definition of aquifer in the actual PA guidance that EPA has put out. And it's very simply defined as a saturated subsurface zone from which drinking water is drawn. And the real key to that and the key to generating points in the groundwater migration pathway is that it is drinking water. And the targets, the main targets for drinking water are people who either are actually affected by contaminated drinking water or potentially affected, that the drinking water they have could become contaminated. So remember, establishing that you do have an aquifer, which is a drinking water aquifer, is pretty important for the HRS score. Now, groundwater may be used for certain resources, and you can get some additional points in the HRS scheme. And it mainly looks at resources, how groundwater might be used to support other resources that are not associated with drinking water. And then finally, you may be at a site or in an area where groundwater could be used for drinking, but it's not. And usually the reasons for that is you might have a poor yield or poor quality in those saturated zones. And then there's also areas where there's a really good high-quality source of surface water. And so groundwater might not be used as much. And actually that's the case in the area where I live in northeastern Illinois. Where close to Lake Michigan, many of the communities there do not use groundwater. They use Lake Michigan water. So sometimes those sites located in those areas, it's difficult for them to score the groundwater pathway because everybody's on Lake Michigan water. So that might be some reasons why you might have an aquifer, but it's really not used. So in the PA, as you're collecting information about your site, these are the sorts of questions that you need to answer in order to work your way through this preliminary scoring. So you need to determine what the local stratigraphy is. And you can usually get that from the USGS or from state geological surveys. They're really good sources for local and regional geologic information. Other sources can include well drillers and well logs, and perhaps university geology departments. And also, if there are other sites located near yours where there have been subsurface investigations, they're also a very good source of information if you can get your hands on that. But you really need to know what the subsurface looks like, where your aquifer or aquifers occur, and what the stratigraphy between aquifers that might overlie one another looks like. Another thing you need to answer is what aquifers serve the nearby areas. So you'll want to identify all aquifers within the 4-mile target distance limit. So groundwater has a 4-mile target distance limit, and you would identify all aquifers within that TDL, and then all wells in each that are tapped into each of those aquifers. In some cases, you're going to be looking at private residences with private residential wells. In other cases, you may be looking at, you know, municipalities using groundwater. Another piece of information that you need to know in order to generate a score under potential to release is the depth to the shallowest aquifer. So during the PA, you should try to determine what the depth to the shallowest aquifer is so that you can score that particular factor properly. So just as with all the other pathways, we're going to be looking at these three factor categories, and they are likelihood to release, which is LR, targets, which is T, and waste characteristics, which we call WC. And in the likelihood to release, you're evaluating if substances have been released to groundwater or how likely they are to be released to groundwater. For targets, you're mainly looking at populations affected, you know, people affected by contaminated or potentially contaminated drinking water. In addition, there are a couple other ways to get points in the target area, and I'll talk about that when we get to targets. Under waste characteristics, you're really looking at the types of hazardous substances that have been deposited at the site, the amount that has been deposited at the site, and the characteristics of those hazardous substances. And all of those get put together to generate your WC. Now, in Module 3 that we did on Monday, we evaluated the size of our sources and the types of hazardous substances that might be associated with the site. And today, we will look at the two characteristics that you of the contaminants that you evaluate, and that is toxicity and mobility. So we figured out our hazardous waste quantity. Today we're going to look at toxicity and mobility and generate our WC for the groundwater pathway. So likelihood of release looks at whether you can establish an observed release to the groundwater, and there's two ways to do that. You can establish an observed release by direct observation, or you can establish it through chemical analysis. And this chemical analysis could be of a monitoring well or a residential well. You have to attribute any contamination that you find back to the site. And in the way that you would be able to use direct observation for the groundwater pathway, so I used to scratch my head and say, well, you know, you can't really see underground. But if you could find facility records that showed that they had disposed of drums or waste below the water table, that would be one way. Or if you during the SI, or if you had existing data that showed that there was a saturated soil sample that was contaminated with site contaminants, and you could attribute them to your source, that saturated soil sample could also be direct observation for contamination of groundwater. Now, potential to, so you get the most points in the HRS scoring system if you can demonstrate that you have actual contamination of groundwater. If you can't demonstrate that, then you should evaluate the potential to release. And that looks at both contaminant factors and site factors in order to determine the score. And you can see in this third bullet, Jean, I don't know where the little green thing is. I've lost it. All right, that's okay, you can see the list. But here are the list of factors that you would look at and that we are going to look at, thank you, as we go through our scoring. So there's, you evaluate the containment of your sources, and there was a question on Monday about whether we evaluate containment, and yes, you do. Now, you wouldn't evaluate containment if you could establish an observed release to groundwater, because obviously you've lost containment. You have a release into the groundwater, and containment isn't that big of a concern. But if you're evaluating potential to release, then you do evaluate the containment of sources, and that plays a role in generating the potential to release score. You also look at the physical state of the sources and the contaminants. So, and that is really best professional judgment. So if you have liquid contaminants that are likely to migrate down through the ground, you would use your best professional judgment at the PA stage to say, yeah, it's probably likely that I do have some migration downward. You would also look at precipitation in the area, the ease with which water will infiltrate to the subsurface. There are special considerations if you are in a karst area. You also look at permeability of the subsurface, mainly by estimating hydraulic conductivity. You look at the depth to the aquifer, how mobile the contaminants are, and then any other analytical or circumstantial evidence that you could develop to evaluate this potential to release. And we'll show you as we score the ABC vacuum site how that all comes together. So groundwater targets are evaluated based on whether they are subject to actual contamination and potential contamination. So actual contamination is evaluated on whether you have level 1 or level 2. And I have a slide on that later, so that's all I'm going to say about that. And this actual contamination must be from drinking water wells. It cannot be from a monitoring well. So the groundwater pathway is pretty stringent in that you cannot infer contamination. If you want to score a contaminated drinking water well, you have to sample it in order to score the population associated with that drinking water well. There is no way to sort of draw a plume and say, now I have this residential well is contaminated and this residential well farther down gradient is contaminated, therefore I can assume the one in between is also contaminated. You cannot assume, you cannot infer contamination in the groundwater pathway. If your own QC doesn't turn that back, an EPA headquarters QC would turn that back to you, and the regions would likely catch it also. So you need to establish which drinking water wells are actually contaminated and then count the population associated with them. And both large municipal wells, groundwater wells that are used for drinking water can be looked at, as well as private residential wells. For potential contamination, if you would look at all wells within your 4-mile TDL and in all aquifers to determine what the potential contamination, the targets associated with potential contamination might be. If you have actual contamination and potential contamination, and that's common at sites, then you only count the those associated with actual contamination in the actual contamination category and not also in potential contamination. You can't count people twice, usually. And I think that's enough. The other ways that you can get points in the target points in the groundwater migration pathway is you could get 5 extra points if you establish that groundwater within the 4-mile TDL is used for agriculture, silviculture, livestock, or food production, or is used as for major recreation in the area. So that is really, do you have it or don't you? do you get 5 points or 0 points? And at the PA stage, you should be looking to determine, are there resources in the 4-mile TDL that you might be able to use to get that 5 extra points? In addition, you need to determine whether or not you have a wellhead protection area that has been finalized and established in accordance with the Safe Drinking Water Act. And if you have one of those within 4 miles of the source, then you can get some points. I believe it's 5 points if it's just within 4 miles. If it's actually underneath your sources, then you can get a maximum of 20 points. And then if you don't have a wellhead protection area at all, you would get 0 points. So during the PA, you should be looking, you know, if you do have wellhead protection areas that have been established near your site and what the bounds of that wellhead protection area is. And that can usually be obtained from local agencies. If an area is a proposed wellhead protection area and has not yet been finalized as a wellhead protection area, it cannot be counted. It has to be blessed by everyone and firmly established. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about actual and potential contamination on the next slide. So the way at the PA stage, right, you've just done site reconnaissance. If you have any analytical data, it's probably existing data. So you're really using a lot of best professional judgment at the PA stage in order to assess whether or not you might have actual contamination and where that might be. So in order to establish actual contamination, you need to know a bit about the groundwater flow. You would want to know the flow direction of the groundwater because that will determine whether or not you have any receptors that are close enough to be, you know, considered as actual contamination candidates, if you will. So that's the characteristics of the site and the local hydrology. Where does the aquifer occur, aquifer or aquifers? Which way does the groundwater flow? And also you'd be evaluating, again, those source types and the quantities of waste, how close your drinking water wells are, how deep they are, and then collect any information you can on closed wells within your TDL or residents' complaints about the quality of their water, and then any existing analytical data that you can find. And then using all of that, those sets of information, use your best professional judgment at this stage to hypothesize about whether or not you think the site could be causing actual contamination. Now, actual contamination is divided into level 1 and level 2. So level 1 contamination is established if you have a drinking water well that is meets or exceeds benchmarks. And those benchmarks are MCLs along with the cancer slope factor and the reference dose for non-cancer causing agents. So you'll see in SCDM there might be three benchmarks, and you as the investigator, and the rule tells you to select the very lowest benchmark. So when your contamination in a drinking water well meets or exceeds one of those benchmarks, you have established a level 1 contamination, and you get to count the population using that well as level 1 contamination. And the math and the scoring of the targets is very favorable for level 1. All level 1 populations are multiplied by a factor of 10. And so if you had just one well contaminated and 5 people drinking that well, that 5 actually is scored as 50 with that multiplier of 10. If you don't have level 1 contamination, for instance, you have a contaminant which doesn't have a benchmark in groundwater, I think that's pretty rare, but it could happen, then you would be automatically using level 2. Or if you have established that you have an observed release, you've met the bar that the contaminant in contamination in that drinking water well qualifies as an observed release, and then but the level in the well is less than the benchmark, then you would score that as level two. And in HRS, level two is scored straight up. So if that very same well, I said, was contaminated at level one, was now really only contaminated at level two, and five people were drinking it, you would get 5 points, five population target points. For potential contamination, you look at all drinking water wells within 4 miles of the sources. So you would locate every municipal, private, or community well. You would determine the depths of those wells and the distances from the sources. You have to determine which distance ring they fall in. And then you would count all the populations served by the wells within the 4 miles of the sources. And groundwater flow direction is not considered in potential contamination. It is by default considered in actual contamination because, you know, the contaminants are going to follow the groundwater flow, and so it's much more likely that your downgradient wells would be actually contaminated. But you get to, you know, draw your 4 mile distance ring and count everything 4 miles and inward, no matter which direction they are from the site. And the potential contamination is difficult to generate lots of points on because there's what I like to call the double whammy of potential contamination. First, it is distance weighted. So you distance weight by going to a table. And we'll show you how to do that. So each of those populations is first distance weighted, and then all those distance weighted populations are added up, and they are divided by 10. So that's the second whammy. So the first whammy is you distance weight, and the second whammy is you divide that by 10. So potential contamination generates a lot fewer points unless you have a very, very large municipal system fairly close to the site. All right, so we're going to ask you to put your thinking caps on here and take a look at this map, and I'll talk about it a little bit. So here we have our source, or our site is by the X, and you can see we've put in all of the distance rings, and this is how they are laid out in the rule, so it just doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4. You first go quarter mile, half mile, then 1, 2, 3, and 4. So they're really six distance rings. And we have two municipal wells located on this map. Well A is located here, and the majority of the population served by this municipal well is within our TDL. And then we have our well B located here, and it's about half the population that is served within the TDL. So go ahead and think about that for a second and pick the best answer from 1, 2, 3, and 4 located there on the right. So we have, how many people we got here? Let's see. I'm going to wait till we get to about 50 people answering.
And if you cannot see the poll, it's appearing in the lower left half of your screen. You should see some boxes to the left of each answer, 1 through 4. You simply check the box or click on the box of the answer that best matches your particular response. Again, if you can't see it, you can also type up an answer in the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. I know some participants with mobile devices sometimes have problems, so you can also type your option. Those options are as shown up on the slides on 4-10, so you can simply type in an answer in the Q&A window if you can't respond to the poll.
Okay. All right, I'm going to go ahead and give you the answer. So those of you who said number 4 are correct. It's not so much a matter of where the people are that are drinking the water from the well, but where the well is. So even though our well A has most of its population within the TDL, the well is located outside the 4-mile TDL, and therefore would not be able to be used at all. And similarly, our well B is within the TDL, so it qualifies. And even though it serves populations outside the TDL, you would be able to still count those populations. So everyone served by well B could be counted for this particular scenario. So good job. I think most of you got that one right. All right, so for many, many of our sites, there are multiple aquifers. There could be a shallow aquifer and a deep aquifer. There could be 2, 3, or 4 aquifers. And what the HRS rule says that you ought to do is evaluate all groundwater targets within the 4 miles of the sources, regardless of which aquifer they draw from. So, and go ahead and evaluate the various scenarios when you're targeting one aquifer instead of another, and there is a way to sort of generate points for aquifers that are beneath the site and beneath your sources and above one another. So aquifer 1 overlies aquifer 2, overlies aquifer 3. So there is a way to score each one of those as separate aquifers, and then use the aquifer that gives you the highest score. The other option that a lot of people like to do is to establish that 2 or more aquifers are interconnected. And there's been a lot of scrutiny over in the past few years about strengthening the documentation for establishing that 2 or more aquifers are interconnected. And the HRS guidance has a really good discussion on the types of information that would need to be collected and demonstrated in order to say that 2 or more aquifers are interconnected. But once you can establish that interconnectedness, you treat them as one giant hydrogeologic unit. So here's some essential well information that you will need to collect during the preliminary assessment and sometimes during the site inspection in order to be able to generate a score. You're going to need to know the location, depth, and screened interval of each of the wells, the aquifers that they are tapped into and withdraw their water from, the number of people that are served by that well. Sometimes the way that's determined is by the number of connections. If it's a municipal well that's being dumped into a distribution system, you would want to know the number of connections served by that municipal system. And then in order to be able to apportion population properly, which I'm going to talk about next, is you would need to know the volume of water pumped from each of those wells annually if they're all contributing to a municipal system. And then you would also want to locate and determine the reason for any closed wells within the TDL. If you have a well that has been closed, either a municipal well or a private drinking water well that has had to be closed because of contamination, and you can establish that that contamination is attributable to your site, then you can count the population associated with that well before it was closed. So you will want to determine in the PA if you can find any wells that were closed because of contamination. Most likely you're going to have to be looking fairly close into your site, unless you're in Nebraska where they got these long, 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 long skinny plumes. Right, Dave?
That's right. Yes,
all right, so
here on that before sites or wells that have been closed due to contamination.
All right. So many municipal systems they blend their water. And they may blend water from several different wells. They may blend water from wells and surface water sources. So the HRS has a 40, what we call the apportionment 40% rule. And you need to apportion population according to the 40% rule. So you have the wells that are contributing to your municipal system, and these wells are located within your TDL. And And then you need to determine if any one of those wells contributes 40% or more to that annual production, then you would apportion the population associated with the wells based on their actual contribution. If no single well contributes 40% or more, then you would apportion the population evenly for all of the wells in the municipal system. So let's do a little, see if you can figure this out. I have one more. Just after this slide, you're going to have a few questions to answer. So this is our setup. We have our site located here, and we have three drinking water wells that are blended together in a municipal system, and that municipal system serves 10,000 people. So in the first case, we're gonna assume that each of these wells, here you have their percentage contribution. So we have DW1 as 30%, DW2 as 35%, and DW3 has 35%. So how would those be apportioned, and what would the population be for each one of those wells? Is there a way for them to answer this one, Jean?
My apologies. Yes, so we now have three polls that have popped up per Teresa's request, and you all have the chance to actually type in an answer for each one of the wells. So you'll see a box for DW1, DW2, and DW3. There should be an empty box at the just below the statement that says assign a population to well DW dash. You can type in your answer right there. If you're having any problems typing in an answer into those polls, you can also just chat it back to us in the Q&A window in the right and simply let us know what you would assign to each one of the wells.
We got some
answers coming in.
Yeah, we got some answers coming. I guess I scroll down to see. It looks like most of you are getting it, except for the people who put 10,000. Remember, that's the total population, and we're splitting that up between wells 1, 2, and 3 based on their percentage pumping contribution. So those of you who recognize that not a single well there contributes 40% or more, and so we follow the apportionment rule and apportion population evenly for each one of those wells. So those of you that wrote 3,333, and some even put the 0.3 in there, that is the correct answer. So you can see the next slide, I think it comes up. Yeah. So that is the answer, 3,333 apportioned evenly amongst all three wells. So let's think about the next one. Here we go. So the way you figure that out is you have the total population, which we had, 10,000 divided by 3, the number of wells, and that's the population served by each well. All right, so let's look at this. Now we're going to switch it up a little, and we're going to say DW1 is responsible for 50% of the pumping, and DW2 are at 25 each. So what population of the 10,000 would you apportion to each one of those wells using the 40% rule?
Okay, so we cleared out your answers, and we've reopened those polls, and you can, again, type in the numeric value for each one of those wells using the polls in the lower left half of your screen. For those of you that can't see the poll boxes, you can also free type in your responses for each one of the DW wells into the Q&A window in the lower right corner.
All right, you guys look like you're getting this one pretty solidly. Except for those of you who put 0, we would be apportioning some population to each well. But it looks like most people got this correct. I see a few more coming in. All right, I'm going to go to the answer. Voila. So we now apportion, according to the 4% rule, in accordance with their pumping percentage. So 50% of the population of the 10,000 population was given to DW1, and that number is 5,000. And then 25% of the population was given to the other two wells, and that's 2,500 each. So when you have municipal systems, you really need to look at the PA stage. If the wells are blended, or if there is a combination of surface water and drinking water. And in the case where there is a combination of surface water and drinking water, you would ignore the population that you apportion to surface water. That would not be counted at all in the mix. All right, let's move on. So in this one, you can see that it's total population times the percent contribution, which gives you the population served for each well. Now, you can also count worker and student populations. And the PA guidance suggests that you really only make a big effort to collect this information if you have worker and student populations a mile or less from the site. And you could count a single person three times. They could be a worker, a student, and a resident. And if they are, they could be counted three times. That's really one of the only times that you can count a person more than once in as a population, as a target number. And what they suggest is that because of that double whammy I talked about, the distance weighting, and then the division by 10, it's usually not worth it to try to collect information beyond the 1 mile distance weighting, beyond 1 mile, because distance weighting will reduce the score so much that it really won't have much of an effect on your overall pathway score. The exception to that would be if you have a large major university, perhaps, or a very large manufacturing complex with a lot of employees located outside that 1 mile distance, but their population is so large that you could overcome the effects of distance weighting. So think about that and what your site looks like and what is around it. All right, so now we're going to get into how we would evaluate our ABC vacuum site in the QuickScore program. And you would go and open up your ABC vacuum, and then you would select the Pathway Score Sheets tab. And once you select that, you are taken to this summary, scenario summary page. And this is a nice page because it always updates itself. So as you're going along and scoring the various pathways, you will start to see the scores come up here on the summary page. But we haven't scored anything yet. We haven't scored a pathway. And so in order to get something on this page, we would open the groundwater score sheet tab. And when you click on that, the next screen you get looks like this. Oh, no, it doesn't. I will show that in 2 seconds. So before we jump into QuickScore, let's think about our ABC site. And we tried to put as much of the site information onto the slide so that you don't have to go back and forth between the exercise handout and looking at the screen as I'm talking. So I'm going to review what we know about ABC vacuum. We know that we have two aquifers of concern. There's a shallow, what we call water table aquifer, and the depth to water in that shallow aquifer is about 30 feet, and it consists mainly of fine to coarse-grained sands and gravels, so it's a permeable, has probably fairly high hydraulic conductivity. And then there's also a deeper aquifer, and the depth to water in the deeper aquifer is about 160 feet. And that consists mainly of fine to coarse-grained sands and gravel. The shallow aquifer is used by five nearby residents, each of them with their own private well. And they are the only private wells that exist within 4 miles of this particular site. The deeper aquifer is used in a blended municipal system that is present within 1 mile of the site. It serves a total population of 8,900 people, and the wells tap the deeper aquifer and are screened at approximately 195 feet. So that information would have been collected from the municipality that is in charge of that system. Groundwater is also used in the commercial crayfish ponds. So there was a commercial crayfish pond located quite close to ABC Vacuum. There is no wellhead protection area located within 4 miles of the site. The site is not located in an area of karst terrain, so you don't have to worry about that. And then based on the 2000 U.S. Census, and of course that would have been updated with 2010 numbers, there is an average of about 3.8 persons per household in Atlish Parish, which is where our site is located in Louisiana. All right, so now we're going to, now that we know the facts about our particular groundwater situation at ABC Vacuum, let's look at what this scoring sheet looks like. So this is the groundwater migration pathway score sheet. And in order to make your version of HRS QuickScore come alive, you need to name the aquifer or the pathway. So once you put the name of the aquifer in here, and we called it the ABC Vacuum Aquifer, and hit enter, the rest of this comes alive and you can enter information into it. You would also want to check that you want to use this aquifer in the site score calculations. Yeah. So what slide am I on? Did I say I was going to take questions and then didn't?
You were going to take questions after 30.
Okay.
Not sure
slide numbers being covered up. I think I am on 420. Okay. So the first thing that you evaluate is whether or not you have an observed release at the ABC Vacuum site. So we don't have any site, any sampling data to indicate whether or not we have an observed release, so we really have to use our best professional judgment. Take a look at the site characteristics and the contaminant types and the hydrogeology, and use your best professional judgment to hypothesize on whether or not you think there may be an observed release to groundwater. And if you say yes to that, then you would select 550 from that drop-down menu, and if you said no to that, you would select zero. But let's think a little bit more about ABC. So based on, and I'm not sure how these pop up, Jean, this is another multiple. Question one, all right, perfect. So based on what you know about the site contaminants that we talked about quite at length and evaluated on Monday, are there site contaminants that are known to readily migrate from the sources to the groundwater at ABC Vacuum?
And you can, of course, also type your answer into the Q&A window. We're just looking for a yes or a no into the Q&A in the lower right, if that's easier.
All right. So that's, I mean, we got a good trend here. So the answer to that, and we agree with you, is yes. We do have some contaminants that are likely to migrate. So if yes, and most of you did select yes, what are those contaminants associated with the ABC Vacuum site that are likely to migrate to groundwater? Is there another poll for this one, Jean, where they just type in answers? Yeah.
Oh, well, nope. I think for this one, this is the wrong one. I think you want me there. So I'm going to pop this up, and we're going to do something really very quick here. And we're going to say, what are these contaminants? And you guys are going to have a box that will pop up in just 1 second where you can actually type up a short answer. and start explaining what you think the contaminants are. So now in the lower left, you should see a box asking, what are these contaminants? Feel free to type in answers in the lower left half, and we will discuss those results once we get a critical mass of answers that have been typed. If you have difficulty using that poll, of course, you can always use the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner to bring in, to type in your answers as well.
All right. Well, most of those answers that I'm seeing are right on. You have benzene, we have phenol, we have chlorinated solvents that we said are represented by TCE. So those of you who put TCE, you know, right on. So, yes, we have, you know, volatile organic contaminants that have a long history of being able to migrate to groundwater. So good job on those answers. You can close that one, Jean. So we picked the same ones you did. Benzene, phenol, chlorinated solvents. Several of you wrote DNAPLs. We don't know that we have DNAPLs yet. Those are dense, non-aqueous phase liquids. I can understand why you said that because, you know, DNAPLs are strongly associated with chlorinated solvents like TCE. But we aren't quite there yet. In terms of our site information and our assumptions. All right, we're going to keep going. What is the depth to the shallow aquifer?
And I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. No, that's okay, Jean. I'll answer that one. Don't type it up. So we know from the PA information that the shallow aquifer is quite shallow. It's about 30 feet below ground surface where the groundwater occurs. And so that's another piece of information that would really lead you to believe that there you could, with confidence, hypothesize that there has been an observed release to the groundwater. All right, so now are there any known users of the shallow aquifer? You guys have already been answering that. And the answer to that is yes, absolutely. There are 5 private residential wells, right, located. Now, in terms of whether these users are up or down gradient, could you make a decision about that? Yeah, we have some people saying yes, some people saying no, more like possibly. And then are there users in proximity to any site sources? Absolutely. Those 5 private residences are within fairly close proximity. And if you take a look, I'm not sure if I have that map in here. Let me go quick. So in determining groundwater direction, you might have been able to find out what the groundwater direction is. You could also generally look at topography. That's kind of dicey, but here we're just trying to use best professional judgment to hypothesize. So if you take a look at the topography of the site, it does appear as if those residential wells could be located in down gradient from sources. In addition, it's hard to say what the pumping of groundwater at the crayfish ponds might be doing to groundwater flow direction and could possibly be contributing to making groundwater flow towards those private residences. So all of those site factors you would sort of collect at the PA stage to determine whether or not you could really hypothesize that there may be an observed release to groundwater. Let's see what happens when I click. So yes, we say there are users. They are possibly down gradient based on surface topography and possible pumping influence from that crayfish farm. And they are in close proximity to the site sources. So that was a yes also. So overall, based on the review of the contaminants, the sources, and the hydrogeology, would you hypothesize that there is an observed release at ABC Vacuum? So most of you are agreeing that yes, there it wouldn't be out of bounds to say that there likely is an observed release. We would agree with you, and to generate a preliminary HRS score, we would hypothesize that we do have an observed release. So we would say yes, and then you would need to decide, you know, what do you need to collect more information about in order to test your hypothesis during the SI? And we're going to do that on the next slide. No, we're not.
I think that's later on.
Okay. So we are trying to connect sort of your use of the preliminary HRS score and how you're hypothesizing to an SI strategy or a site inspection strategy, where you're going to focus your resources, where you're going to collect your samples, what information you're going to chase. You need to sort of start jotting down as you do your preliminary scoring. Which part of our observed release hypothesis do we need to collect more information about in order to prove up? But right now, we would be happy to put 550 in the observed release because we think it's a plausible hypothesis for the ABC vacuum site. And then let me click next. All right, because we want you to be able to do it, and it's also useful to see if you had to score the site based on potential to release, what sort of score would it generate during the preliminary scoring. And so we're going to run through this particular scenario. But first, I am going to pause and take a few questions. So Jean, if you want to open it up for questions now, we can do that, and then we'll do it again at the end.
Okay, so we do have a few questions that were typed up electronically already, but we'll go ahead and remind people, if you haven't done so, you can submit your questions and comments for our instructors in the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. So you simply click your mouse cursor on that empty box and type up your question and hit the Enter key, or click the little cartoon-looking bubble to the right to privately submit it. Our first question came in, and this one states, is the likelihood to release a subjective or objective metric? It seems that others could refute the value if it's not an objective metric.
If you're saying you have an observed release and you're giving yourself that 550 points, that's very objective. You have to have evidence of the observed release. The subjectivity really comes in when you're scoring potential to release, but in the preliminary scoring that we're doing now, we're using a lot of subjectivity to score that. But if you're scoring on potential, by the time you get into the SI and the HRS package, that is also quite objective in that all the facts have to be supported by references. So, in the PA stage, you are dealing with less certain information, and so you're using best professional judgment, which makes it seem subjective. But by the time you get to the HRS package, everything is pretty much proved up. Would you agree, Dave?
I would totally agree. I mean, at the PA stage, you have next to no information other than what you can gather from maybe previous investigations, so you have to use a lot of subjectivity in avoiding, you know, improper NIFRAP or no further remedial action decisions in kind of proving up your assumptions.
Right. You wouldn't want to kick it out based on wrong subjectivity.
Right.
All right. Any more there, Jean?
Yep. We have another question asking, what determines the interconnectedness of aquifers?
There's a bunch of ways to determine it, But it's basically, is there some sort of impermeable layer that is continuous between the aquifers and that would stop groundwater contamination from migrating downward? And if you've been around in the industry a long time, you'll have heard, that aquitard is solid and it's extensive. And then you get out in the field and you start looking at drilling logs and putting in your own borings, and you find out, well, it's really not that extensive. And you can find areas where it is actually not present. And so to establish interconnectedness, you need to show that somehow they are connected. Either that barrier that you thought was there is not contiguous, or it has been breached by some other method, including the installation of poor installation of wells. And I would refer you to the HRS guidance, which has a long, long description on how you establish interconnectedness to satisfy HRS.
Yeah, I think another way too is if you would have contamination in the deeper aquifer that's also in the shallow aquifer, and that contamination in the deeper aquifer is attributable to your site, then you have shown that contamination can migrate across that impermeable layer.
Yeah, you could do it, you could use a pump test. Now, at the PA stage, you're not going to have a pumping test, but perhaps a pumping test has been done, at a nearby site. And you could maybe use that data, but that's where you're pumping the lower aquifer and you see a response in the upper aquifer that shows interconnectedness. So I would refer you to that HRS guidance manual. It talks about all the various ways. I think there's like 7 ways. So we don't have time to go into them in much detail here. Any more, Jean?
Yep, we got a couple more. One question is pertaining to the 4-mile distance. How do you handle a site that is not a point? Let's say it's a 500-acre site. Would you take the centroid and measure 4 miles, or do you mark off an area 4 miles from the site boundary?
You're drawing your boundary, your TDLs, based on your sources, not your site boundaries. So whatever that source is, or sources, and if you have multiple sources, there's ways to draw multiple TDLs. So you would draw 4-mile TDLs around each of your sources and then combine them. There are various ways to do that, but you're not going from a site, you're going from sources.
Okay, our next question is referring to slide 4-8. I'm confused as to which is the level that describes more contamination. What does, quote, meet or exceed mean? Is that a higher concentration? What is, quote, less than the, quote, benchmark? Is that saying that the concentration is below the benchmark?
Yes. So if it equals or exceeds a benchmark, then the contamination that you're finding in your drinking water well, let's say your benchmark is 2 parts per billion. So if the contamination in your drinking water well, in your target well, is equal to or greater than 2 parts per billion, you're at level 1. If it's below 2 parts per billion, you're at level 2.
Okay, and then we just had one last comment, and I'm not quite sure exactly what it, if it's a question or just a general observation, but they state whether this site should have even gone to the SI. So I don't know if that relates to part of the scoring exercise or if there's a point where you should reflect on that before you even get this far.
Well, that's what we're trying to determine here, really. We are going to take our PA level information and put it into QuickScore and sort of hypothesize about what scenarios we might have and what those pathway scores might be under worst case conditions. And then the investigator would get together with the regional coordinator, regional MPL coordinator in the region the site's located, and decide, should this site go forward for a site inspection? If so, what is the priority for that site inspection? So that's really the question we're trying to answer. Should we go forward with this site?
Have you already talked about conceptual site models?
Yeah, I think that was in Module 2, I believe.
Okay. So we're kind of in the early stage of a conceptual site model here, making some hypotheses, and we'll test them at the SI. If our hypotheses show that the site has the potential to score.
Right. Remember, the guidance is pretty conservative in that they don't want to rule anything out at the PA stage unless it really should be ruled out. So when in doubt, when there's an uncertainty about it, EPA is usually going to be cautious and go forward and collect additional data to make sure that if they're going to kick it out of their system, that it really should be kicked out.
Okay, I think we'll close this question portion now and carry on with the presentation.
All right.
But participants can keep typing them up, though, throughout the entire broadcast, and we'll take another break shortly.
Great. So now we're going to go on to talk about potential to release, and we're actually going to score potential to release for the ABC vacuum site. And it evaluates four factors. So you would need to collect information about these four factors during your PA. You need to know containment for all of the sources. You need to know the net precipitation for the area, the depth to the aquifer, and the travel time. And all of those get combined together to generate your potential to release score. I'm going to take you through part of that, and then Dave is going to pick up and finish it. So when we need to first evaluate containment. And so we would have to look and evaluate the containment for each source that we have at our site. And you do that using HRS Table 3-2. Now, we included a full copy of Table 3-2 as part of the participant manual, but I've also clipped out the relevant portions and put them on a slide. So if you don't want to flip to that page, you don't have to. So the Table 3-2 includes descriptions of the conditions for the various source types and gives point values for each of those descriptions. Those point values can either be 10, 9, 7, 5, 3, or 0. And then what the HRS rule tells you to do is once you assign a containment value to each one of the sources, you get to pick the source that gives you the highest value and use that value for scoring purposes. So we're going to look at each one of these sources as we go along. So we have our drums and our tanks. And the drums, there were 255-gallon drums that were stored on a concrete pad. There is no berm around the pad. So there is no containment of the pad itself. The tanks are also located on a concrete pad, and they're covered by a metal shed, but there is no berm or secondary containment noted for the tank area. Now we're going to take a look at what Table 3-2 says about drums and tanks. And so these are the descriptions that you see. Is there evidence of hazardous substance migration from the container area? You would give a 10. If there is no liner or impervious base under the container area, it would get a 10. If there is no diking or similar structure surrounding the container area, it would get a 10. And then you can see as you go down, the point value decreases for the more containment features that you have. So the highest score that you can get is a 10, and that is usually a real lack of containment. So based on these descriptions in Table 3-2, that was for drums, here's for tanks. You see they have below ground tanks and above ground tanks. Our tanks are above ground. You can see the point values and the descriptions. So So based on those descriptions and point values, what containment score would you give the drum storage area, and what containment score would you give the mixing tank area?
And we have more of those short answer polls appearing in the bottom left half of your screen. Again, you can simply type your answer in the empty box below the question where it says type your answer here. And of course, you can also use the Q&A window if you'd prefer to submit your answers that way.
All right, I kind of got to move on. I feel like we're short on time. So we would have given both a 10 based on the descriptions in table 3-2 and the site conditions observed during the reconnaissance effort as part of the PA, the preliminary assessment. Now let's move on to our lagoon and our oxidation pond. So we have historical reports of hazardous waste disposal in the lagoon. There's stained soil in a drainage ditch that the lagoon discharges to. There is existence of a liner of the lagoon is unknown, but there are no other containment structures noted around the lagoon. For the oxidation pond, again, the existence of a liner is an unknown, but visually looking at the oxidation pond, there was no containment structures noted. So if we take a look at surface impoundment section of table 3-2, here's the descriptors, and here are the point values. So, based on that, what containment score would you give to the lagoon and oxidation pond? It can't get a 20. Whoever wrote 20, maybe that's a typo. That would be rejected in QC. All right, most of you are getting this right. It is 10. That's the maximum value. We would also assign a 10, and really because of the lack of any containment structures observed during that PA reconnaissance, and no site records indicating there was ever a liner in either pond or impoundment. All right, let's do the stained soil and rubbish pile. So we have the stained soil there. There are three areas in the ditch that surround the site that are where we believe we have evidence of hazardous substance migration. And of course, it's just stained soil in a ditch, so it has no liner. The rubbish pile appears just to be a big pile of, you know, trash and garbage and concrete and rubble located on the ground. There is no containment structures are noted in the PA reconnaissance. So again, you'd have to take a look at the descriptions. And in this case, these two particular source types fall into this all sources except surface impoundments, land treatment containers, and tanks category. So based on this description, what score would you give each of those for containment? All right, see lots of 10s, and that's the same score that we would agree with. So that really takes us to having all of our sources with a 10. And so we would pull down this drop-down menu, and we would select 10 as our containment score. So we got our maximum points on that one. All right. So next, we are going to evaluate net precipitation. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Dave. I just wanted to say a few words about Dave. This is the first webinar that he's taught, but he is one of our instructors that we use frequently for both the PASI and HRS course when we've given them face-to-face. He's been doing that for EPA for about 7 years now. In addition, Dave has large number of years, tens, decades of experience actually preparing, conducting site assessment work and preparing HRS packages. And he is currently the site assessment manager running Tetra Tech site assessment program in Region 7 under the START contract that we have with the Environmental Protection Agency. So he has a lot of very practical site assessment experience. All right, take it away, Dave.
Thanks, Therese. Well, let's get into the second factor of the potential to release, which is net precipitation. You can see it here in the quick screen screenshot. Again, it is going to be a drop-down menu. And my forward thing is not working here. Oh, there it is. Again, it's going to be a drop-down menu where you can select the values from 0 to 10. And I'll show you how to get those values. Net precipitation is not the same thing as mean annual precipitation. There's kind of three rainfall measurements you need for HRS scoring. Mean annual precipitation and something called the 2-year 24-hour rainfall are used for the surface water pathway, but the groundwater pathway uses mean annual precipitation.
Hey, oh, Dave,
sorry.
Before
it
you
uses,
go any yes? further, if you could pretend like you're shouting into the phone, a couple of people have asked for you to get just a little bit louder.
Oh, okay. All right. So net precipitation considers mean annual precipitation and evapotranspiration. We're looking at the total amount of rain that falls minus the amount that transpires through plants and also evaporates due to hot, humid, or hot days. It can be determined two ways. It can be calculated site-specifically with meteorological data, which is very difficult to do. There's actually a formula in the HRS rule that will show you how to do it, but through my many, many years of scoring sites, I have never calculated the net precipitation manually. The easiest way to do it is using HRS Figure 3.2. All you need to know is where the site is, and you plug it into a map, which is here. This is straight from the HRS rule. We know that ABC Vacuum is in Louisiana, so you just pull the value straight from that map. So there's a participant poll here for the net precipitation factor value. What is the correct net precipitation value for ABC Vacuum site? Is it 6, 10, 3, 1, or 0? Yes, it looks like the majority, almost 100% of the respondents. Well, I'm sorry, there's a couple other ones here that are coming in at a 10 and a 3. It looks like the majority are going with the correct answer of A, 6. Which is what we assigned to it. So if we move on to the next slide, you would enter 6 from that drop-down menu. And now we have values for containment and net precipitation. The next factor that we will look at is the depth to the aquifer. Again, it's a drop-down box where you select the appropriate answer. What the depth to aquifer evaluation is looking at is the distance from the lowest known point of hazardous substances at your site to the top of the first aquifer being evaluated. Intuitively, you would say that smaller distances are going to give you a greater score, and that's absolutely correct. You're going to have a higher potential to release if you have a shallow water table. HRS Table 3.5 is going to be presented on the next slide. Provides the factor values and range of depths to which the values apply. You'll notice that you can either get a 1, 3, or a 5. Also note that if you have a karst aquifer underlying any portion of your site, you assign a thickness of 0 feet. Since we do not have karst at this particular site, we are going to pick a value from this table. And notice the breakpoints here of 25 and 250. So those are kind of key, all these breakpoints in HRS scoring. If you're close to one of these breakpoints, you want to be extra careful in assigning a value and getting good information to do that. So the depth to aquifer at the ABC vacuum, what is the depth to the shallow water table aquifer at ABC site? And remember that we are looking at the lowest, also need to estimate what the lowest known point of hazardous substances is in the ABC sources. So we need to know what the depth is and also how deep the known contamination is. So it looks like the answers for the depth to aquifers are pretty constant, 30 foot. The answers for the lowest known point of contamination, that's more subjective, but they look pretty good at about 5 foot, 3 to 5 foot. So we said that the contamination was at least 5 foot deep. So the depth to the aquifer, therefore, would be 25 foot, and if you remember from that table, that 25 foot corresponded to a value of 5. So you would select that value of 5 and move on to the final factor in potential to release is the travel time. And what we're looking at in the travel time is the least permeable layer in the unsaturated zone. That's the zone between your site and the top of the water table. We're looking at the total thickness of the least permeable layer of that unsaturated zone. And things you have to remember when you are selecting a value for travel time is that the first 10 foot from ground surface down is not considered. A second thing you have to remember, that any layers that are less than 3 foot in thickness are not considered. So at our site, we would eliminate the first 10 foot and look at the remaining 20 foot of material. And what kind of material do we have here? We got sands and coarse sands. It looks like it's pretty homogeneous. There's a couple stringers of coarse sands embedded in that looks like a fine sand. So we got about 20 foot of that. We'll use table 3.6 from the HRS rule to determine what the hydraulic conductivity of those layers are. And this is from the HRS rule. You'll notice that the clays, low permeable till, get a very low hydraulic conductivity value of 10 to the minus 8. Silts, lusses, silty clays, and sediments that are predominantly silt get a 10 to the minus 6. Sands, sandy silts, 10 to the minus 4. And gravel and clean sands are 10 to the minus 2. So which value would we assign for this site? It's going to be somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 2. We're saying 10 to the minus 3. And that's a estimate based on, again, best professional judgment. Now we'll use table 3.7 and the hydraulic conductivity from the table 3.6 that we just pulled out to determine the score for travel time. What we want to look at is the total thickness of the lowest hydraulic conductivity layers in the unsaturated zone, and also the corresponding hydraulic conductivity for that layer. At our site, we had greater than or equal to 10 to the minus 3 for the hydraulic conductivity of that sand/gravel layer, And the thickness that we determined was somewhere around, what'd we say, 20 foot. So it looks like we are going to end up with that 35 for the travel time factor value. Again, if you have karst or a depth to aquifer that is 10 foot or less, you're automatically going to get the maximum value for potential or for the travel time of 35. And as I said earlier, if you had this layer that's at least 3 foot thick, they have to be at least 3 foot thick before you consider them. So from that drop-down menu from line 2D, you would select the 35, and then the QuickScore program will automatically calculate your value of 460. You can see the formula right here is containment, line 2A, times the sum of lines 2B, 2C, and 2D. So it would be 10 times 46 to get your 460. QuickScore will then assign the higher of observed release, which we'd had already assumed for the ABC vacuum site, or potential to release, and enter that value under line 3, likelihood of release. So the next thing we need to do, once we have our likelihood of release determined, is let QuickScore calculate our waste characteristics. And what we'll have to do is assign a toxicity mobility value for our site using the hazardous substance having the most toxic and mobility product. And I'll show you how to do that on the next slide. So we have already populated here a list of contaminants that are associated with the site. What we'll need to do is select each one, contaminant by contaminant, determine whether it was deposited as a liquid or non-liquid, and whether we're in a karstic or non-karstic environment. There is also an option here that says in an observed release that will automatically maximize your mobility factor value. But since we have no samples at this point, we have to select from one of these four bullet items for each contaminant. So you highlight your first chemical. Then you choose whether it was deposited as a liquid or non-liquid, and whether you have karst or non-karst underneath your sources at the site. For the ABC vacuum, we assumed that all these contaminants are going to be deposited as liquid and that we're in a non-karstic environment. So once you select that bullet, liquid non-karst, the program will automatically populate the toxicity of arsenic, the mobility type, the mobility value for arsenic, and it'll provide the product of the two here. So you want to repeat that process for all chemicals one at a time, and after that's done, you'll see that all the toxicities are in here, the mobility types, the different mobility values, and the products of mobility and toxicity. You'll see the highest one is TCE that has a toxicity mobility product of 1,000. When you're through entering all of those values, click Save and return to the score sheets. That will take you back to your groundwater overall score sheet, and you'll see that the program has selected TCE as the contaminant having the highest toxicity mobility score. When that is combined with the waste care or hazardous waste quantity factor value, it automatically assigns a waste characteristics factor value of 18. So once you're done with that step, you now have likelihood of release determined at 550, and your waste characteristics determined at 18, and we're ready to move on and start assessing targets. So for the targets, we want to use our best professional judgment to decide if there is actual contamination. I think we've already done that and already determined that we do have actual contamination. We want to be sure and be conservative at this stage at the PA because we really don't have data to say they're not contaminated. Is there actual contamination in the shallow aquifer where we have five private residences? And is there actual contamination in the deeper aquifer where we have the municipal system and the well screened about 195 foot below grade? So here's an overview of the site again. You can see the five private residences here with their domestic wells. You'll see that the flow in the ditch is this way toward the south and the west. Kind of on a bigger scale, there are those five private residences again. We have the crayfish ponds here where we know that they are drawing water for the commercial production of that food. We have municipal wells B and C right within 1 mile, between a half and a mile. Municipal well A is kind of a side gradient, but it's a little bit closer, between a quarter and a half mile. You can see from topography, we got a 25-foot line here, a 20, and a 15, so topography is sloping this way. So in evaluating the targets, the first factor we look at is something called the nearest well. And each of the pathways in the HRS looks at the maximally exposed individual, and this is what the nearest well factor is. It is kind of further described in section 3.3.1 of the HRS rule. There's also several tables, table 310 and 311 in the HRS rule, that will provide additional guidance. But what they basically say, the section says, if you have a drinking water well used by people that is subject to level one contamination, regardless of how far that well is from your site, you're going to receive a nearest well score of 50. If you have a well that is subject to level two contamination, you'll get a 45. If you have no drinking water wells that are subject to level one or level two, you'll get a value of 20 if the aquifer is karst. Otherwise, you'll determine the shortest distance to any drinking water well from any source and use that distance to assign a value from table 311, which we'll look at here in a second. Again, these were the benchmarks to determine whether you have level one or level two. The HRS uses MCLs. MCL goals, as long as they're non-zero goals. You've got screening concentrations for cancer risk that corresponds to the 10 to the minus 6, and screening concentrations from non-cancer toxicological responses that relate to reference doses. And SCDM, the Superfund Chemical Data Matrix, automatically populates and calculates these values for you. This is Table 311 from the HRS rule. Again, if you have a level one, you assign a value of 50 points. A level two will give you a value of 45. If you have a well from 0 to 1/4 mile from your nearest source, that's a value of 20, and on down the line. So for the ABC vacuum site, we have those nearby wells that we think may be contaminated, and we think they may be contaminated above a health-based benchmark. So our best professional judgment says that we have at least one of those wells that is contaminated at level one concentrations, which would give us a value of 50 for the nearest well factor. Now we will look at the next factor, which is population, and we're going to look at population as either level one, level two, or potential. And Therese talked about this earlier and the various multipliers that we will use and apply to each one of those sub-factors under population. So in scoring level one contamination, we're looking at the number of people served by drinking water from points of withdrawal that are subject to level one concentrations. We want to multiply the total number of people served by those wells by a factor of 10. For the ABC vacuum site, we have five households that use shallow water aquifer. The average number of people per household from the 2000 census was 3.8, which rounds up to 4. I think at the PA stage, it's okay to round. So if we have five households, about 4 people per household, we're going to get a total of 20 people subject to level one concentrations. And because they are subject to level one concentrations, the quick score program is automatically going to multiply those folks by 10. You can see you enter the 20 people in this level one concentration line 8A, and the program will automatically multiply that by 10. And then we'll move on to level two. So the sum level two contamination is just the number of people served by drinking water from points of withdrawal subject to level two, and is just the number of people counted straight up multiplied by one. There is no factor of 10 here. And you just assign the sum as the value for this factor. For the ABC's site, we cannot assume level two contamination because we've already assumed they were subject to level one. We can make some assumptions about other wells, such as the deeper municipal wells that could be level two if we choose to at this point. But we did not assign any level two concentrations because we had already counted those shallow wells under level one. Now we'll move on and see how to score potential contamination. For potential contamination, we want to include all the wells within the 4 miles of sources that have not been scored as either level one or level two. For our site, we have these shallow and deep aquifers that we are considering one hydrologic unit. We're saying they're interconnected. We know we have 3 municipal wells that are blended and serve a population of 8,900 people. We are going to apportion the population using the 40% rule. We're saying none of these wells serves more than 40% or produces more than 40% of the total. And then once we have done that, we're going to determine the distance weighted population using a value from the HRS table 3-12. So these are our wells, A, B, and C, and the distance from the site. Well A, remember, was kind of side gradient, but it was within a half mile of the site. Well B and C were down gradient, and they're between a half mile and a mile of the site. Here's the annual production of each well, 30, 35, and 35. And using that equal distribution, we take the total population, which was 8,900 folks, and divide it by the 3 wells. So each well is serving about 2,966. Our next step is to total the number of wells or people in each distance ring. So we only had that one well A, in that quarter to a half mile distance ring. The population served by that one well was 2,966. In the half to 1 mile distance ring, we had wells B and C, so we want to add their population at 5932, and then we're going to remember those two populations because we're going to apply them to table 312, which is that table that distance weights. So here is table 3.2 from the HRS rule, and I'll show you several things about this table. It's got a top half and a bottom half. The top half is for other than karst, which is what we have at the ABC site. The bottom half has different distance weights for a karstic aquifer. This column is the various distance rings that the HRS considers, 0 to 1/4, 1/4 to 1/2, so on and so forth. Along the top are the number of people within each distance or number of people within categories. So you'll notice the categories are 1 to 10, 11 to 30, 31 to 100. Again, these numbers between 10 and 11, between 30 and 31, 100 and 101 are breakpoints. For our site, that first well, well A, was, it served a little under 3,000 people. So it would fall into this population range, and the distance was 1/4 to 1/2 mile. So the assigned value for well A would be 1,013. For wells B and C, their total population was about 6,000, which would fall into this population category. And their distance was 1/2 mile to 1 mile from the site. The value that we get from table 3-12 is 1,669 for those two wells. So you'll notice that the farther away from the site you are, the less and less the population you're going to get. So here's our distance weighted population. This was the actual population served by the wells. This is the table 3-12 weighted population that was served by the wells. What we'll do next is add those populations up, 1,113 plus 1,669, and divide by 10. Remember, Therese said it's like the double whammy. You get distance weighted, and you also get hit by a factor of 0.1, or you divide by 10. So our potential contamination is now 668. The HRS rule does tell you now to round to the nearest integer, and you go to 268 is the value that we now enter on. I'm sorry, you don't enter the value. You enter the value, you enter the actual value, the actual sum, and the program will hit it by that 0.1 multiplier. What the program does now is it sums the 200 for level 1, the 268.2 for level 2, to get a total population value of 468.2. And that is the population. Next thing we want to look at is resources. The last two factors are going to be resources and wellhead protection area. For the resources, we have that crayfish farm, which uses groundwater. So we are going to get a factor of 5. If you had irrigation wells that irrigated 5 or more acres of commercial crops, you would also get the 5, or there are a number of other factors that will get you a 5 as well. We have no wellhead protection area that was noted, so at this point, the best we can do is 0. We don't get any points unless we can document ourselves up. What the program then does is going to calculate a aquifer score. It multiplies the likelihood of release, the 550, times the waste characteristics, times the target score, notice lines 3 by 6 by 11, and divides by 82,500. Therese showed you that formula in the very beginning, and it gives us a 62.79. And that's our pathway score. And I think the maximum pathway score you can get is 100. I don't know if you talked about this in the earlier modules, but I think you need a maximum pathway score of at least 57 to get the overall site score to a 28.5 that would be enough to qualify for NPL listing. So based on the assumptions we made, the five wells subject to level one contamination and the contaminants and the waste quantities, whatnot, we could have a site that could potentially qualify for NPL listing. So one of the beauties about QuickScore, especially in the PA stage, is to play lots of what if games. You know, what if you only had four of those wells that were contaminated, and the number of folks went from the 20 down to 16, what would happen to the score? Or what would happen if only the wells were subject to level two contamination? Or what if the municipal well were subject to level two or level one? What would happen to your site score? So it's a good way to hypothesize using your best professional judgment as to, you know, what may happen or what's likely to happen at your site. When you go out and design your SI sampling strategy, you will want to test a lot of the hypotheses that you made during your quick score scenarios. So what elements of the groundwater hypothesis would need to be tested with our SI strategy, our sampling strategy? What are some of the items that we want to be sure to collect data when we're out in the field doing our SI? One of the things we want to do is confirm the types of contaminants present in the sources. This is going to be done by looking at facility records and, more importantly, by actually collecting samples from our various sources to confirm what contaminants we actually have in the environment and the sources at our site. We want to confirm the groundwater flow direction in shallow and deeper aquifers. We don't consider groundwater flow direction when considering potential targets, but we certainly want to know that when we're developing a sampling strategy to be sure to sample all the receptor wells in a down gradient direction from our sources at the site. We want to confirm water quality of the five wells of the adjacent private residences and the municipal wells. We would certainly, in an SI, want to go out and sample those wells. While we're sampling those private wells, we need to ask those residences how many people actually use the drinking water on a regular basis. One of those wells, they could have a daycare, and you can count the children that are in the daycare as well as anybody living in the house as receptors in those private wells. So be sure to confirm the number of residents served by the five private wells. And finally, you want to get some idea of the crayfish farm. You know, how much their groundwater is pumping, what level and frequency they pump to assess any potential influence on the groundwater flow direction. And finally, you want to determine if the shallow and deeper aquifer can be treated as one unit. You can do some more digging with geological surveys, look for well logs showing the absence or presence of that confining layer. So that wraps up the last half of the presentation. Therese, do we open it up for questions now? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Okay. We did have a few questions that came in, but participants can continue to type them up in that Q&A window in the lower right corner at any time. One of the first questions that came in, but I think the participant was able to sort of self-answer by playing around with QuickScore themselves, but I'm going to read it out loud anyway just to have you clarify for everyone. The participant asked, does the HRS Quick Score tool have these reference tables stored in their interface?
The reference tables, as far as the SCIDM program, it is tied to SCIDM and the values from the Superfund chemical data matrix, which we call SCIDM, that have mobility factor values, persistence factor values, toxicity factor values for all the various contaminants that are in there. And there's also links to, I think they're highlighted blue in the the actual Quick Score program. If you click on one of those blue table or blue links, they will actually take you to a PDF of the actual HRS rule itself. So you can read the text and look at the actual tables.
Okay, what about a list of substances? That one of the participants commented that their Quick Score tool does not populate a list of substances to pick from.
Did they, I wonder if they had scored all their sources or if they started with a blank slate. Because you have to evaluate your sources first and associate contaminants with your sources. When you move into the actual pathway evaluation, it should automatically populate that toxicity mobility screen with contaminants.
Okay, and they did clarify to say that they had started with a blank slate.
Okay.
Okay. All right, excellent. So our next question asks, must the potential to release be assessed if the observed release scores 550?
I wouldn't. I think we went through that potential to release just to explain what the various factors meant. And if you had to score it, if you did not assume an observed release, you would want to score potential to release. And we just wanted to show you how to do it.
Okay. Our next question asks, looks like, in the, quote, ABC case, since there are several layers of clay between the shallow and deep aquifers, we would likely consider these two separate aquifers. Is that correct?
I don't see the layers of clay, but let me
we had the cross-section.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a cross-section that did show layers of clay. We didn't have any scale on them. Those clay layers could have been less than 3 feet in thickness, or we may have had additional regional information that would suggest that the aquifers were interconnected. I think for the exercise, we assumed that they were interconnected, but the Quick Score program does allow you to evaluate multiple aquifers. I think one of the first things you do before you can start entering information in that groundwater migration score sheet is name the aquifer that you're evaluating. So if you had two separate aquifers, you would evaluate aquifer one, maybe as an observed release, and then evaluate a separate aquifer, a deeper aquifer, possibly as potential to release. And that's discussed in more detail, I believe, in the HRS class. But but it does allow you to evaluate multiple aquifers. I hope that answered it.
I think so. We had one participant include just either what they think is a typo that they found, and they're not sure where it came from because they were following along. So let me read the statement out loud. I was following along with inputting data for the aquifer for scoring the groundwater pathway. When I assigned mobility, my waste characterization came up as 18 rather than the 32 shown in the presentation. I'll add that the HRS assigned a toxicity mobility factor of 1,000 as opposed to the 10,000 as shown in the presentation.
That's a very good question.
Yeah, so we had this course has been in existence for quite a long time, and that was a screenshot that we used that we shouldn't have used, and it was a screenshot from when the TCE toxicity value was a lot higher. I think it used to be 10,000.
Yes.
So that was our mistake. I should have changed that particular screenshot to update it, but that is a good catch. It should be 18 because there was a change in TCE.
And you know, and that brings up a very good point as well. I am not sure what the current Quick Score, which version of SCDM it ties into, but occasionally the Superfund chemical data matrix is updated based on new toxicity data from the risk assessment world. And before, well, certainly before, if you were going to actually score this site to the national priorities list, you would want to make sure that you are using the most current values from the Superfund chemical data matrix. And you can find those online. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time for Quick Score to get updated.
Okay, let's go with another question from our participant who says, if residential wells are listed as, quote, unknown in the well indices, besides door-to-door questioning, what other resources might be used to determine whether well owners might be using the groundwater for potable sources?
Therese, you want to, I'm not quite sure what the, what other resources other than door-to-door surveys?
I would think you would start at the local level, like local health department, county health department, to see if they have any records for residential wells in the area.
You know, sometime we've contacted cities who have billing records for, you can compare water billing records versus electric billing records, and sometimes a residence will get an electric bill but not a water bill. So it leads you to the assumption that that residence has an alternative source of water. So sometimes checking with the local utilities will help as well.
Okay. And then our next question, can we get a little overview on level 1 and level 2 contaminants? I think that you would look at the MCLs from the test results. Is that correct?
Well, you would look at either MCLs, reference dose, or non-cancer screening concentrations, or cancer screening concentrations. All these numbers are in SCDM. A contaminant may have three different benchmarks, or it may only have one. Typically, it has something. You would use the lowest benchmark. So for TCE, the MCL is 5, but I believe the cancer screening concentration is around 0.9. So you would use the 0.9 in determining whether you had level 1 or level 2. You could have a concentration in a well that is below MCL, but it might be above a cancer screening concentration, which would give you level 1 concentrations in that well.
Okay. We have a comment that, and this is, I think, was a supplemental comment to one of your previous statements. I'm so sorry. I'm going to add in this other clarifying comment. One of our participants is suggesting that some state agencies have private water supply well construction reports that can be searched by locational information, and that might be another resource that they could use. So thank you for sharing that comment. We had one participant who wrote the following in. I think this was just in reference to another statement you were making earlier. And they say that you would basically have to answer the scenarios in Table 3-10, if I understand this correct. So I'm not sure if you know what that reference or what answer that was referencing.
3-10, I think, listed the benchmarks, right?
Right. 3-10 is the benchmarks that are used
the groundwater path.
In scoring a site, yeah, in the groundwater pathway, the MCLs, MCL goals, and the cancer and non-cancer screening levels. So you would have to know what those are for a given constituent to determine whether you're at level 1 or level 2.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
Oh, I see what they're saying. Yes, is there a place where you can look at all of the ones to make that determination? Because you can't enter concentrations in Quick Score in private wells. what you would need to do, you can go to that Google search or go to EPA's website and search for Skidham, and it'll take you to the page where it is, and you can print out all of the Skidham values in a tabular format that has the benchmarks, all of the benchmarks for every compound. So you can look at what the lowest benchmark is for your assumed contamination to make your level one or level two hypotheses. I think that was the question.
Okay. We're going to take two more questions, and then we'll go ahead and close things out here today. Our next question asks, regarding the question about several aquifers, would it be okay to be conservative and assume a single aquifer with an observed release rather than to separate them, since your knowledge about the interconnectivity is not enough?
I would say at the PA stage, you could, you know, the beauty of QuickScore is you could do it both ways. Look at it one way as interconnected, and look at it a separate way as separate aquifers, and see what the difference is. If it scores one way and not the other, you would certainly want to spend additional resources trying to document the situation such that you can achieve the highest score for the pathway. But I think at the PA stage, it's probably okay, unless you've got strong evidence otherwise, to assume that they are interconnected. Do you agree, Therese?
Yeah, I agree. And then note for yourself that this is an area of uncertainty that you need to prove up in your SI.
Okay, let's take one last question, and this actually gets into the HRS score, I believe. One participant would like to know, what does it mean that groundwater may be the only one needed to score a site over the number 28? What does the number 28 mean?
The number is actually 28.5, and that's the minimum HRS score that your site needs to be considered as a candidate site for the National Priorities List, a Superfund site. So there is an equation once you go through, and I think there's a module at the end, where you evaluate all four pathways. There's a root mean square equation that calculates your overall site score. But just based on this one pathway, kind of a rule of thumb, is you take a one pathway, divide it by two, and that will be your overall site score. So if you had a pathway score of 57, divide that by 2, you're going to have an overall site score of 28.5, which is enough to qualify for listing. So since we had a 67, I think it was, our overall site score would be 33.5, which is above the 28.5 necessary for listing the site to the NPL, if all of our assumptions were right.
Okay, that's the end of the online questions that we have for today's session. So I'll turn it to Therese and David to see if they have any final statements they'd like to leave the audience with before we go over our last closeout reminder items.
The only caution that I give, because I've made the mistake myself, is that when you start running scenarios in QuickScore, to just see, you know, what happens if I change one number here or I assume potential, just make sure that you're changing all the appropriate numbers. One number people frequently forget to change is the nearest well. So they put a 50 in there, and then they decided to run a scenario on potential only. Well, if you only have potential contamination, you have to change that 50 to 20 or less in order to really get a true scenario number in front of you. So I just caution you to sort of go slow and take a look at all the numbers and make sure that you've changed everything you need to change when you're running scenarios.
Good point.
Okay. Well, with that, let me go ahead and walk everybody through our final closeout reminders. And we are going to carry on with the seminar series here. We're going to continue on with module number 5. That very next module will take place in just a few days. Again, we are recording each one of the modules in the series, so if you haven't had a chance to take modules 1, 2, 3, or 4 before we kick off module 5, we will get you links. We will have links for module 4 here in just a few moments ready for everyone. Again, module number 5 will carry on July 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern. If you haven't signed up for the upcoming modules in the series, you can do so following our training calendar at cluin.org/live. We are available to help you look up your training records here at Cluin. Although we don't necessarily provide these lists publicly, participants can go to the following URL and actually enter in their email address online. And if you do that, we'll automatically send you a table listing all of the webinars that you've participated in using that particular email address. If you need any further help, you can always send me an email at balance.gene@epa.gov. To help document or at least look up your participation records. We are going to remind everybody that the seminar slides as well as the exercise handout, or I think they're calling it the participant guide for today's webinar, has been attached and is available on the additional links or resource page. You'll also find a few other guidance documents, including the one for SIs and PAs, posted there. So I encourage you to visit that page. Again, if you're watching the recorded version of today's webinar, those links are still active, so you can follow them either from the links in the Q&A window or under related URLs that appear on the middle right of your screen. And then, of course, we do have our online short feedback form. I would ask if you could take just a moment and fill out that short feedback form and let us know what you thought about both the training mechanism that we used for today's session as well as the content that we covered. Each person can fill out their own feedback form, so if you shared the line with multiple people, once you fill that form out, there's a link to let another person hop on and fill out their own version of the form. The link for feedback is active from this point forward, so again, if you're watching the recorded version or you simply don't have time to share feedback today, you can certainly come back and access that URL and share your feedback after the live delivery. One thing I will point out, if you're looking to really document your attendance, we are encouraging participants, when you submit your feedback, make sure your email address is entered correctly, and then check a box which is circled in red on the slide. That box will then send an automated email to you as soon as you submit the feedback form, at least confirming that you shared feedback with us after the live delivery was held. So if you couple those confirmation emails along with presentation materials or registration emails, that's usually enough to help document your participation with other accrediting institutions. Again, if you want to earn full credit and get a custom certificate from us for this webinar series, you'll need to be sure to participate in all 9 modules in the series, and we're asking that you try to do that in numerical order through some mixture of live and archived replays. I think that's the end of the reminders I have for today, so I want to thank the nearly 120 individuals who were able to hop on and join us for today's live broadcast. I want to thank both of our instructors from Tetra Tech, and hope that we'll all see you carry on with the module next week on July 11th as we, this week as we carry on July 11th with module number 5. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.